Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the show. I'm your host, Brian Elliott. I just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for listening and helping to make this show what it is. We've had a rush of new fans and followers lately, and I couldn't be more excited to be on this journey with you. Behind the Brand started as a side hustle because in 2008, my little startup was in trouble. I had just resigned from a big brand marketing job at one of the biggest studios in Hollywood. My dream was to open a production company with a focus on building brands through the art of storytelling. But it was looking like the Great Recession was going to get the best of me, and I didn't know what to do. That year, I read a book called Tribes, written by one of my favorite authors, Seth Godin. It became a roadmap for me and a North Star to navigate very choppy waters. Spoiler alert, I made it through some of the toughest times I've ever had, and now this show is dedicated to all of you, as well as anyone else who's trying to build a successful business and brand. Here's a little mixtape I made of Seth's top 10 lessons. Let's get into it.
So high school is a disaster for a whole bunch of reasons. And one of the reasons is it happens at the very same time we are developing the ability to intentionally talk to ourselves. Most people, if they're honest, cannot remember what they said to themselves when they were 7 years old or 11 years old. But once we hit high school, it's loud. That voice in our head, it's working overtime. I think it might be related to our sexual awakening at the same time. But at the very same time that that voice is getting loud, so are the other voices in the lunchroom. So are the other voices on the bus. And we tend to mimic what's around us. If you grow up where everyone is speaking French, the voice in your head is going to be French. And if you come of age with high school voices in your head, it's not unusual to develop high school voices. And I think growing up is a persistent effort to get rid of those voices. And a lot of it has to do with fitting in. A lot of it has to do with listening to inappropriate feedback, criticism from people who are more afraid than you are. A lot of it has to do with surface achievement, which isn't really that important compared to the other kind. So for me, the work, and I have to do the work every single day, is to calm down, quiet down, isolate myself from the voices that aren't going to help me do my work, and to figure out how to amplify the other kind, the ones that are about the practice and the work we do, not about fitting in, standing out, or winning. So a couple things to say about feedback and criticism. The first one is this. Most of the negative criticism you get is not helpful. And it's not helpful because it's simply a way of someone saying, it's not for me. So if someone who loves a steakhouse leaves a one-star review of a vegetarian restaurant on Yelp, should the vegetarian restaurant now start serving steak? I don't think so. This person told us about themselves, not about the restaurant. And if you give a one-star review to a brilliant book like Cast by Isabel Wilkerson, you're not saying anything about the book. You're telling us something about yourselves. Isabel should not read that. It will not help her. And that's the first part. And then the second part is people who do exist in your audience, who it is for, most of them are bad at giving feedback. Most of them are terrible at telling you something that will make your work better. It's a craft. It's a skill. I'm not surprised they don't know how to do that. If you can find someone who knows how to do that, what a gift. I mean, think about a movie like 2001, which is regularly considered one of the 10 greatest movies of all time. When it came out, people walked out of the theater. When it came out, ostensibly talented critics hated that movie. What if Stanley Kubrick had had a focus group before he released that movie? First 45 minutes with no speaking. Well, we wouldn't be talking about monoliths the way we're talking about them right now, would we? And the reason is because Stanley Kubrick had something to say, and he willingly ignored people who didn't know how to give feedback. Writing a blog every day has been a fantastic practice for me. I don't know how many people read it. I don't seek to monetize it. That's not what it's for. What it's for is I made a decision one time to write every day. And so I don't have to revisit that decision. I don't post a blog post because I feel like it. And I don't post a blog post because it's perfect. I post a blog post because it's tomorrow. And that idea helps the work move forward. it's super easy to point to the person who came before and say, it's too late. That ship has sailed. Well, you know, Facebook launched years after Friendster. And I mean, go down the list. Being first is, you don't get a big prize for being first. That it's fun. I love to go first, but that's not the point. The thing is, I had to persuade people. I can show you this in my business plan. I had to persuade people that one day folks would have email. That was a key stumbling block in raising money for my company. One day people would have email. Well, now we don't have to have that discussion anymore. So now if you want to build, I just saw it the other day, a YouTube channel that does nothing but show people how, with wordless videos, how to restore old metal toys from the 60s, there's nothing stopping you. And he regularly gets 5 million views per broadcast. Now, what does 5 million mean? If you think about Mad Men, considered one of the two greatest TV shows ever made, Mad Men was seen by 3 million people an episode. This guy, who is busy refinishing Tonka trucks from 1964, has 5 million viewers per episode. So, yeah, this is the moment right now.
You got to decide if you're a freelancer or an entrepreneur at any given moment.
Yeah.
So, Mondays between 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock, I'm an entrepreneur. I made that part up. But, and the rest of the time, I'm a freelancer. I'm on stage. No one wrote my content. If you read a blog post that I wrote or listen to a podcast I did, it's me. There's nobody behind the scenes. I have zero staff when I do my freelance work. Zero. I make every slide. That's my craft. When I thought about the Alt MBA, I said, what would happen if I acted like an entrepreneur in the sense of I'm not allowed to say I'll do that part of the work. I just have to find extraordinarily talented people, give them the freedom, gain enrollment, and help them get to where they're going. Yeah. So the discipline of the Alt MBA for me is not that I'm trying to build an entity that I could sell. It's that I'm trying to build an entity that scales in a really juicy personal way that I as a human could never scale. And that every time something shows up for the Alt MBA that I could do and I alone could do, we take it out because that's not allowed. Right? So the E-Myth Revisited is the classic of this work on the business, not in the business. That there is a model of entrepreneurship that says every job should be done by the least skilled available person so you can pay them the least amount. That if you can just build a business with all of those building blocks, where you're never overpaying for a different task, at some point you will extract maximum value. But my overarching belief is culture doesn't exist to make capitalism better. Capitalism exists to make our culture better. Use it when you need it, but we're not here for capitalism. So maximizing your profit isn't the goal. Maximizing your life and your impact is the goal.
Right.
So what's missing from Tony's sentence, which he probably meant to say, is you're doing it wrong if your goal is to maximize your profit. I agree with that. I just don't understand why maximizing your profit is the goal. A generous hustle is when you show up with generosity to do something for the other person with no end in sight for you. Almost all of us like a generous hustle. Almost all of us want someone to coach us, encourage us, open the door for us, take us to where we need to go. So I'm a huge fan of the persistent, generous hustle. I have a real problem with people who are following some dummy's playbook. They send you an email saying, what's your favorite color? And then you write back, and then the next thing they say, will you be my mentor? And then, right? Like, there's this method, which probably came from the pickup community years ago, and the idea that we could manipulate somebody else to help us get what we want, it doesn't have a place. It didn't have a place before. It doesn't have a place going forward because it doesn't scale. It doesn't build trust. It's not who we want to become. So my encouragement to people is work even harder than you thought you could work, but work on metrics that matter. And the metric that I think matters the most is trust. Who would miss you if you were gone? Who's expecting something from you that you can deliver? Who trusts you? And we get that way by being generous. So So to pivot into your second question, the essential thing to understand about social media as well as cable TV, you are not the customer. You are the product. You're the product because if they can get you in a certain mental state, you will use it more. And if that mental state involves shame and inadequacy, you will be more likely to not only use it more, but to engage with the things that are being sold to you.
Yeah.
So the metrics that are exposed, the makeup virtual and real that is shown to make everyone else's life look better, is designed to make you feel shamed and inadequate. And it is up to you if you want to play that game or not. But the people who play that game don't win that game. They just get to play the game and be sad all the time. And we know this. We know that the more you use certain kinds of social networks in certain ways, the sadder you get. And all you got to do is look at 50 years of Hollywood to see the corrosive effects of that. Because between the Academy Awards and the makeup artists and the who has a bigger house in Beverly Hills and everything else, none of those people are happier than they were yesterday.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you're going to be in this world, accept that you're the product, not the customer, and use it for your own benefit and the benefit of the people you care about, not because some algorithm decided you would make them a profit. Leading and managing are not the same things. They are as far apart as they could be. Managers get things done that were done yesterday, except they get them done faster and cheaper over and over and over again. Management is about compliance and power. We need management. Leadership is about none of those things. Leadership is about gaining enrollment, sharing a vision, and then trusting people to help you get there, even though you don't know how. Because if you knew how, it would be management. Right? And so leaders are wrong all the time until they're right. They're like a plane flying from here to San Jose. They're off course the whole way, and the pilot adjusts until she lands. That's leading. It's not managing. And what it takes to be a leader then is to see your own fear and to understand the narrative of the people you seek to lead to gain their enrollment. And Kelly has done some unbelievable work in talking about how we can do this, each one of us inside the Alt MBA, because it's about selling people, not on why you are right, but on why we should all be enrolled in where we're going. And if you're good at that, it doesn't even matter if you were right, because the journey itself is a big part of what we signed up for, and we're willing to do it again. And so the reason that entrepreneurs need therapists is not because of management, it's because of leadership. Managers don't need therapists. Managers just need to be more clear. But leadership in a place where you have to get people's buy-in and can't order them around, that is hard work. Every time I've ever been in a room with Jeff Bezos, he's been the smartest person in the room. And that counts Ted. So that's a pretty big deal. The ratchet, which I haven't talked about yet, that he is building is, I think, pretty profound. One of the basic human needs ever since there has been stuff is to acquire stuff. And to think that one could corner the market on the process of acquiring stuff was so audacious that no one even expected he meant it. That he told Barnes & Noble what he was going to do, and then he did it. And then he announced to each one of the industries he was going into exactly what he's going to do, and he's done it because his ratchet is so powerful. So let me explain what I mean by a ratchet. If you go to the hardware store, you can buy a wrench that when you go this way, it puts in friction, but when you go this way, nothing happens. So it can only go one direction. If you think about certain kinds of technology, Kevin Kelly has written about this, there are technology ratchets. If you get a smartphone, odds are the first week you only used it half an hour a day. But using it makes you use it more, which makes you use it more, which makes you use it more, and it ratchets in one direction. It turns out that when people move out of abject poverty and enter a middle class, there's a capitalist ratchet that goes into play, because each person has just a little bit of spending money, which enables them to engage with a merchant, which gives them more spending money, and the whole ratchet continues. So our goal, if we're going to build something of substance, is to say, what's the ratchet that as this gets used, it gets used more? And I think that what's profound about the seven businesses where Amazon is thriving is that most of them have a ratchet associated with them. So I don't own stock in any companies on purpose because I'm really bad at this, but it's hard for me to see when that ratchet breaks and how it breaks, but it's been absolutely stunning to watch. I think they haven't taken as much care with some of the innocent bystanders as they could. And I think that in retrospect, they probably would do some of those things differently. I hope so. And that as AI starts entering this process and we start dealing with other countries and we start dealing with kids and we start dealing with how are we shading people's choices, I think their responsibilities are through the roof and they better own them to be good citizens. But from a business point of view, there's a ratchet going on there, just like Google search turned into a ratchet. Tom Peters, 25 years ago, controversially said, you should have a regular session to help your entire team improve their resume. Because if the only reason they're staying is they can't get a job somewhere else, you don't want them. That you want to be the place of choice. And if they have a weaponized Class A resume and they still can't find a place better than yours, now you're going to have the right kind of retention, not the retention of laziness or inertia. But the second name check is the idea of Jeff Moore and Crossing the Chasm plus Everett Rogers' product adoption life cycle. So let me try to do this with an invisible piece of paper and an invisible Sharpie. There's a normal distribution here. Can you all visualize that? It's called the normal distribution because 88% of the people in the middle are normal and the 12% of the people on either edge are weird. And normal people have certain buying behaviors. So for example, they all waited till DVD players were $88 at Walmart before they bought one. Very few normal people bought a $5,000 DVD player. They waited. Normal people, right, don't have a 12 flashing on their VCR. They got rid of the VCR a long time ago. It's the center of the market. Well, this idea, as Rogers pointed out, that a product moves through the curve. Certain people buy it when it's new, brand new Tesla Roadster 9 years ago, because they want to tell people they have the new thing. Some people wait till everyone has one. People like us do things like this. And some people have to be dragged at the last minute because their Model T has no parts available for it, right? And what Moore pointed out is that in between the early adopters, the geeks, the nerds, and the normal people, there's not this stepwise wonderful curve. There's a chasm, a gap, because these people want something totally different than these people. And the best example is the Newton. Everyone says the Apple Newton, what a disaster, total failure. Actually, it sold more than 100,000 units in just a couple months. These people bought it. I bought it. But these people said, it doesn't work, and didn't buy one. Failure. Fell into the chasm. So now when we're thinking about recruiting and hiring, exactly the same math works. There are some architects who want to work at Skidmore, Owens, and Merrill. Is that still called that? SOM? Because they're right in the middle. They can brag to their parents. They can point to the buildings. It's not just safe. It's prestigious. It's status. It's tell me what to do, surround me, but with enough soft tissue that I'm not going to get in trouble. And then there's people who say, yeah, I got hired by Facebook. I'm the in-house software architect, and I'm using everything I learned from Taliesin to design user interface so that they can tell all their friends, I'm working on something new. Right. So you got the best of breed nerds and early adopters to join you at the beginning. But these people have changed as humans, and your institution has changed. And so now you have to take a deep breath and say, well, do I need those thrill seekers to leave so that I can bring in the kind of heavy hitters that get me Marriott as a client, right? Because a lot of firms do that. Or do you say, we're always going to be here in the froth and I'm building a studio, right? So that was the choice I had to make 10 or 15 years ago, because lots of people have built, you know, much more significant institutions from the base that I was starting from, because IBM calls you up and says, we need you to train 7,000 people. Well, that means you need a whole bunch of trainers and blah, blah, blah. So you move through the curve and do this. And I said, well, I could do that, but I like the froth. So I have a studio. And what it means to have a studio is you have turnover, and turnover is okay. Because when people get bored, well, now they have a resume that's going to get them into Skidmore at a higher level. Congratulations. I'll write you a letter of recommendation. You didn't fail here. You succeeded here. But what we do at a studio is we're always going to take cutting-edge projects that don't make us enough money, that where we're under-respected but over-applauded. That's what we do. It's a studio. So if you're going to do that, own that. Be clear with the team. We're looking for more frothy early adopters. And if you need stability because you've got your third kid on the way, let me help you find a place to do that. Or you say, nope, we're a different kind of firm now. And if you're begging me for the zing, I don't have a zing here anymore. Here's someone who just graduated from school. I'll help you go there. Because that's what we've got now going forward. We're way more similar to the Hollywood model of we create value by putting together the team that's going to make Black Panther. And that team's never going to work again together. But they'll remember each other 3 years from now. And when I need a few of them, Mission Impossible style, I'll put them all back together. Because that's where the yield is. We can't build the factory that cranks it out the way Ford did for 60 years of record profits. Facebook's not going to have 60 years of record profits. Facebook's got a 10 more year run. And then something else is going to be next. So that model is, again, a shift from what our parents taught us. But between 1983 and 2000, no one talked about telephone marketing, 800 number marketing. We used the phone, but we were talking to each other. We didn't call it phone marketing. And just because it's digital doesn't mean it's different. We're still humans. There's a series of tactics. There's a series of dials that need to be turned. Someone cheaper than you could be hired to turn those dials. Soon, computers will turn those dials. That the iterative process of scientific advertising and iteration is going to get more and more done by AI and computers. It's a fairly easy problem to solve in the long run. But being human, that's like one of the last problems AI is going to solve. And so that's the opportunity, is don't tell me you're an expert at Facebook yield optimization, because that might be worth a dollar today, but tomorrow it's worth a dime. Tell me you're an expert at seeing humans for who they really are and what they're afraid of and what they want to become, and that you're good at telling a story that's true, that lights up their eyes. And if that's the case, it doesn't matter if they're dialing 1-800-ABCDEFG or if they are working on the cutting edge of augmented reality. None of that matters. The technology is going to keep changing. We don't need technology specialists. We need humans.
We just spent a couple weeks ago, we were with the Bentley Group, you know, the people that make really, really expensive cars. Mm-hmm. They're not Toyota. They're not selling millions and millions of cars. They're selling a few hundred every year, and that's good enough for their model.
Right, but there's a huge cost to this. Let's be really clear.
Yeah.
The cost is the distance from zero people buying a Bentley to 500 people buying a Bentley is very narrow. So what you have to do is extraordinary, unreasonable things to make it so that 500 people will cross the street to sign up for what you do. Mm-hmm. You know, so in that basket over there, I have dark chocolate from 10 different countries, 20 countries, 30 different craftspeople who make dark chocolate. Now, I'm obsessive about dark chocolate. I don't drink wine, so I use my wine budget to buy dark chocolate. Fine. What do you have to do to get me to buy your dark chocolate?
Right.
Very good dark chocolate doesn't cut it. Extremely good dark chocolate doesn't cut it. I'm not going to even talk about extremely good dark chocolate, but I'm going to talk about Rogue or Soma or Askenozy, because Sean Askenozy doesn't make extremely good dark chocolate. He makes insane dark chocolate. That's the cost. The cost is, if you don't want to make average stuff for average people, you have to make unbelievable stuff for a few people who care.
Yeah, you have to differentiate yourself some way, right? If you don't have the biggest budget in town, and you can't rent someone else's audience, your product or your service or your thing has got to be so remarkable, right?
Right. And what remarkable means is worth making a remark about. So it's not up to you, it's up to me. If I'm going to talk about it, then it spreads. But you don't get to decide what's important to me. I get to decide what's important to me. What often happens with entrepreneurs, because we have so much trouble with our mother-in-law and so much trouble with the money and so much trouble with everything else, is when it comes down to it, we back off just a little bit. At the last step, we said it's good enough. Actually, it's not. That's that last step where you didn't push it off to number 11. That's when you stumbled, because you said it's good enough for everyone. Yeah, but you're not making something for everyone. You're making something for me.
So how do you reconcile then this idea? Because you talk about shipping it a lot. Reed Hastings has talked about, you know, if you ship your product and you're not embarrassed about it, write it first, you ship too late. Maybe help reconcile what you just said.
Okay, so I'm not sure Reed and I completely agree.
Okay.
And I have never said, what the hell, just ship it. Never. That's what people who are afraid think I'm saying.
Right.
What I'm saying is you will never be ready. You should be prepared, but you'll never be ready. Because what it means to be ready is it's going to work.
Okay.
And you don't know it's going to work. So when Gutenberg launched the printing press was amazing. By today's standards, it was terrible. But by those standards, it was amazing. Except 94% of the people in Europe were illiterate. So it was a stupid time to launch the printing
press. Too soon, yeah.
When Carl Benz launched the car, it was against the law to drive. There were no roads and there were no gas stations. Really dumb time to launch the car. He couldn't possibly be ready. So what I'm arguing is not that you should ship things that are sloppy or flawed. What I'm saying is, if the thing that's holding you back is you're saying to yourself, it's not ready, it's not perfect, those are the symptoms of fear. And you will never, ever get over that fear, because the easiest thing to do is not ship it. And what I'm saying is the discomfort we feel with shipping feels differently between I shipped it and I'm embarrassed because it's sloppy, and I shipped it and I'm not sure it's going to work. Those are two different things.
How do we push through the resistance? You talked about the resistance a lot. Give us some tips about how to, you know, this is a mental game, right?
Over our shoulders are many copies of Steve Pressfield's book, The War of Art, and the sequel, which I was lucky enough to publish, Do the Work. And Steve named that voice in our head the resistance. It's the thing that gives us writer's block. It's the thing that can turn you into a shriveling heap of jelly.
It's the fight or flight.
Right. But you cannot push through it. That's a mistake. It doesn't go away. What it does is it becomes someone you can dance with. That's the distinction. So I've been backstage with some extraordinary people. The best ones get nervous before they go on stage. It doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. If you're waiting for it to go away, you're going to wait forever. What you do is say, oh, I feel this and I'm about to go on stage and I'm about to ship it. That, as we talked about with the marathon, you can't make the tired go away, but you can learn to put it somewhere.
Interesting. Yeah, Adam Grant has a book out on creativity. He talks about turning that anxiety into anticipation or a looking forward to.
Correct.
So shifting.
Correct. And so I don't believe there are geniuses. If I'm a genius, you're a genius, we're all geniuses, or no one is. What I do believe is there are people who know how to dance with that feeling, because of cultural reasons, because of who their parents were, because of something.
Mm-hmm.
And they start pulling a thread. And if we look at the earliest work of all the people we say we admire, right? I mean, Mark Zuckerberg's early work was super sloppy and expensive and ended in litigation. That the first versions of AOL were dumb and the management didn't know what they were doing. I mean, go down the list of any business you want, any nonprofit you want. It never starts well, but it begins. And then we pull the thread and we pull the thread. And as we're pulling the thread, we're getting better at our craft. And the only way to get good at our craft is to do our craft, not to study our craft.
Are we talking about emotional intelligence? Is that what this is about?
Well,
being able to put certain emotions in certain places?
I think that one of the things that they teach kids at good schools is this idea of metacognition, which means thinking about thinking, which means instead of having a tantrum, say, I feel like I'm going to have a tantrum. That if you can do that, you have a chance to let your executive function kick in.
Right.
And what we know is that the executive function is the thing that separates winners and losers now, is when cool-headed, calm people look at their alternatives, they make better decisions. And what do we do for a living? We make change. And how do we make change? We make decisions. That's what we make now. And if you're making it with this instinctual thing, then why are you surprised you're not very good at it?
I mean, we were just sitting back, you know, chopping it up, reminiscing about the good old days and all that. You know, tracking my roots, where I came from and where I'm going. But like I say, man,